Congressmember Rokana, the U.S. is pulling out of Afghanistan, but actually leaving thousands. I mean, there are going to be mercenaries there. There's going to be entire intelligence, CIA operatives. Phyllis talked about the setting up, them helping to set up death squads. What is should be the U.S. role after?
Well, first of all, I give President Biden credit for pulling out our troops. He had to overrule, as I've read in the papers, the advice of his own generals. He is a president who has had the courage to end this war when many previous presidents have not. I believe it shows us that we can't intervene in a civil war. The Taliban, no doubt, are brutal actors who have no regard for women and human rights. I don't think we should sugarcoat that. They have committed extraordinary atrocities. And disproportionate atrocities. I don't think there is a moral equivalence between the Taliban and the current Afghan government. But as the other guest has suggested, the Afghan government hasn't had clean hands. They have committed atrocities as well. And there's simply
we have 5 seconds.
Nothing to be gained by the U.S. Intervention and involvement there.
We want to thank you, California Congressmember Rokana and Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Certainly something we will continue to cover. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. We've got Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
Good morning, everybody. I am Paul Rowland, your regular weekly host on Wednesday Talk Radio. And we are at the second Wednesday of the month, which means that I have on the phone, I'm in the studio, and I have on the phone with me my regular second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning.
And Jacqueline is a Diné or Navajo and Dakota a local writer and activist, been active on many issues and has a number of published books. Most recently, I can't believe it. Please go ahead and say the full title.
My book's called Stand Off.
Okay. I was thinking Stand Up. I don't know why that got stuck in my mind there for just a second.
No. That'd be good, too. I mean, well, Standoff refers to, of course, the book covers 2016 when I was reporting on the standoff at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge here in Oregon in January and early February of 2016 when Ammon Bundy and his group took over the wildlife refuge and occupied it with arms. And then again, at the, after April 1st of 2016 through the pretty much February of 2017 when folks at Standing Rock on the north of Standing Rock Sioux Reservation had a standoff with the Dakota Access Pipeline. and I covered that as well. And you know, I am Dakota. My family have long-standing ties with Standing Rock, and also Navajo. My mother's full-blooded Navajo, and so I write on issues. And yeah, and I guess, you know, a lot of Native journalists don't like being called an activist, you know, because it sort of takes away from their professionalism. But, you know, I think that when you're in conflict with the colonial power, what other role can you do, you know? And certainly journalism has often failed us as far as full coverage of the issue and proper framing. And what my book Standoff tries to do is to sort of illustrate the ways in which these standoffs that happened in 2016, how they impact American politics today, how they reflect the history of colonization, and what we can do about it.
So. Well, and of course, before you became a regular guest and then a regular co-host, I think I first had you on as an activist on the Mascotry issue, which is something you've been involved with for quite a long time. And I know that's one of the subjects you wanted to tackle today, given that the Portland Winterhawks have changed their logo and the Cleveland Indians finally changed their name. So we'll get to that. But there's a related to the Malheur standoff. Well, kind of one is directly related, one is more loosely related. Speaking of Eastern Oregon, I think you wanted to talk about the Nez Perce land back issue. And then another one we want to tackle was the just a little bit of update on the Klamath Basin. And of course, Ammon Bundy was involved in that, and he was involved in the Malheur. So these things all, a lot of the same characters involved in a lot of these things, and obviously a lot of the issues continue to recur. So what do you want to tackle first?
Wow, there's a lot going on in Native issues, just even here in Oregon. And and yeah, it was a really beautiful day when the Nez Perce tribe got to reclaim land. I should say that it's not a land back in the sense that white people gave land back. And I'm not sure if the audience is all familiar with that particular movement, which is an indigenous-led movement to encourage colonists, settlers to return land that was taken under really terrible circumstances. And certainly the Nez Perce story illustrates that. I know I've discussed before with the Burns Paiute tribe and the way they were forced marched, in chains, in snow, to basically walk all the way to the Yakima Reservation in Washington State and banished from their homelands. And the same price was paid, of course, in the Wallowa Valley, there in northeastern Oregon, where the Nez Perce tribe was driven off their land. You know, women and children were murdered as they were fleeing. And this was all done by the U.S. Army, right? And now we're looking at what's happening. We just listened to Democracy Now! And what's happening in Afghanistan. These things have happened here in the very land that we live in today in Oregon. And the land was taken in ways that were violent and terrible, and so that other people could benefit from them. And you see that playing out with the Klamath River Basin water fight, where these folks who have been brought in, settlers, have water claims that were promised to them by the government and are not being fulfilled, and it's leading to conflict with tribes who have senior water rights, because of course, you know, tribes were here first, and therefore so there's a tug and pull against those farmers in the Klamath Basin and fish habitats further down the river. And so it's all a part of why we have this political standoff. The rural white, mostly white, sort of pushback, which is armed and given a lot of latitude, and versus that of people who are trying to find a more just way out of this history and out of these circumstances. And so it's it really does illustrate the full spectrum of that.
Well, just to clarify and get into this a little deeper, so there's I think two parcels of land involved in the Nez Perce. One was the main thing that they actually purchased. So it's not, as you say, not a land back, 150 acres in Wallowa County, their original homeland, which I guess was finalized in December. And then just this article was just actually July 30. They had a ceremony where the tribal leaders rode back to their sacred place on horseback in a ceremonial parade. But then in May of this year, Wallowa Methodist Church gave them actually the land and building of the former United Methodist Church in Wallowa, Washington.
Yes, yeah, that was what happened.
No, Wallowa County, Oregon, I guess is what it is.
Yeah, yeah. So there is a ranch that they purchased that is in a sacred area called the, I can't pronounce it in their language. And I should note that the Nez Perce call themselves Nimiipuu. That's their name for themselves. And so the ranch that they purchased, or land they purchased, 150 acres, is near the town of Joseph, Oregon, and it's called Unzakpa. Not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. It's the place where boulders are scattered about. And so, so they've been beginning to gain a base. They were originally taken to Oklahoma after they were, I guess, how can you say, but, you know, rounded up by the U.S. Army and sent to Oklahoma. And then now they have a reservation in Idaho. And so, but this return to their homeland, which I should note that places like Burns, Oregon, where the Malheur Wildlife Refuge is, and the Wallow Valley in northeastern Oregon, these are both places that are very low population, which means these people, the Nez Perce and the Paiute people, their lifeways, everything, their rights, their very lives were forfeit just for a very small number of white settlers to have the right to occupy their homelands. And I think that the Harney County, where Burns, Oregon has a population of only 7,000 people, and they often say there are more cattle than people there. So whole cultures were destroyed, and human rights were violated and ignored, and people's lives, of course, were taken, and even children were murdered, just so these few people could have the land. And now these are the same, you know, this rural land sort of is a source of, I think, a lot of the right-wing politics that we're seeing, and certainly it is. It's the way the land was allocated, and the whole system in which it has been run has promoted white supremacy, which has, I believe, been really at the center of a lot of these far right, we call far right, but seem a lot less far right since the majority of Republicans believe a lot of these sorts of far right stories. And I think the majority of the Republican Party doesn't believe that believe the election was stolen by President Biden is not the actual president. Trump is still the president, and so you can see the way in which I believe the way land is used and allocated, and the way the way it was done in the 19th century here in Oregon it really plays into the present standoff and political cultural conflict that we face. Which was in the streets just this past weekend. You know what I mean? Here in Oregon again, and it plays on many other fields, including trans rights, LGBTQ rights, and where people were in the streets in California this past week fighting. And so these issues are real. These issues are impacting our lives and still endangers so many people.
Yeah, I was listening to you, and I was also just scanning through a little bit this article. There's many articles about this. I didn't link to them, any of them yet on my our program page. This is from the Seattle Times. They were driven from their land in 1877 by U.S. soldiers. Now the Nez Perce tribe is home again. This is obviously a time of great celebration for the Nez Perce. There's so many bad things happening. It's nice to focus on some positive things that are happening in Indian country among Native Americans. And anyway, it just goes into a lot of the terrible history. They really just hounded, you know, it was an extermination campaign against the Nez Perce back in the mid-19th century. And I don't know, just looking at the original homeland, which was quite extensive.
Yeah, it's over 7 million acres. And, of course, now they're celebrating eating 150 acres.
You're right.
And, I think we don't contend enough. And I'm not, and yeah, the land back movement, you know, obviously in Oregon, in Portland, we had last year the Yale building was returned to a Native arts organization from a white arts organization here in Portland to the Native Arts and Culture Fund, and that's a huge example here in Portland. But of course, it's something that I don't know. I think in my book, obviously, I think this is really helpful. The land back movement is really helpful. I believe I'll have to talk to the folks there, but I believe this is a movement that was started by an organization called the Indian Collective, E-N-D-N, the letters N, D, and N, and then collective. And but they have been really trying to promote this idea of land back. I don't know if they're the originators or they're just trying to really provide a focus to it on a national level. But I think it's a really good device, like I said, for framing an issue, for getting people to think about it differently. But I think I'm not sure how effective it will be in really changing, you know, because I think these issues are structural, right? It's not individual, although these individual acts, I think, are an incredible statement and do push things forward I think it is really good. And but I think that we need to look much more critically at how in my book I refer to American citizens as colonists, right? And the U.S. is still a colony because these aren't their homelands. These are the homelands of many of hundreds of indigenous nations, right? And the U.S. still holds as law the doctrine of discovery, which basically is sort of a legal argument put forward by the Supreme Court, Chief Justice John Marshall back in the 1830s, about 200 years ago, put forward the idea that that Native people have no rights to the land. Right? I know that sounds completely the opposite of what you would think. You would think indigenous people would have rights to land. But under this legal stratagem, I should call it, the doctrine of discovery, only discovering European Christian nations have legal title, right? So the minute that a discovering European nation, pretty much a nation under the Pope, right, comes and lands on our shores, then immediately the fee simple title, which is a legal term, the fee simple title of land reverts to that discovering nation. At that point, the monarch, the crown, becomes the landholder, you know. And so this is why they think that we don't have title, right? The United States, of course, did not exist when this papal bull was written in 1492 and 1550. There were two papal bulls written by two popes, but Marshall argues that the United States inherited the status as a discovering nation because it was a colony of England, which was a discovering nation and under the Pope at the time. And so this is where the U.S. gets its land claim title, not just by conquering or military, but through this argument that that Native people intrinsically lack the right to have title because we are not Christian, because we were not under the Pope of Rome, the Vatican, in 1492 and 1550. and because we are not from somewhere else, right? And so this is completely turns the notion of land rights on its head, this idea. But it's incredibly, of course, self-serving, right? But this is the basis of land title. So when you, as a U.S. citizen, you know, go and purchase things or live on this land, you are participating and you are basically agreeing to this doctrine of discovery. And I think that's something that American citizens need to think much more deeply about. They are part of a system that that basically appropriates land from Native people. But at its very core, is that that's what it's all about, right?
You know,
and there needs to be a reordering of this system, and that's where I think that the change will really happen.
You know, I was wondering, as you're talking about, obviously the, you know, the Protestants themselves, the Protestant nations as they emerged during the, you know, the nation state building period, they inherited that doctrine, as you're saying, the doctrine of discovery, and obviously they didn't protest against that aspect of the papacy. But anyway, I was wondering if the I'm reading through this article and I know some churches have talked about the doctrine of discovery. I know there's various initiatives to, you know, to get this whole legal edifice overturned. And I know there's been some efforts within, you know, the churches. The various popes have been approached to renounce the doctrine of discovery, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't see anywhere that the Methodist Church actually, it would have been an opportunity, and maybe they did, but to bring that up, you know, as a small gesture of, you know, since they're giving the land back, to sort of, you know, make a conscious choice to include that as part of it. But anyway.
I can say the Episcopal Church has. Uh-huh. They have a very strong movement that they've built for the last, at least I think, almost 20 years now, trying to dismantle the doctrine of discovery. I think they have a website actually called Dismantling the Doctrine of Discovery, an initiative they've been leading. So, but I'm not sure about what the Methodist Church has done. But there, there is a Native Methodist Church here in Portland as well. And there has been a lot of ongoing critique of it happening. You know, there's whole conferences happening about it, and so it's something definitely that. But I think it's still something that most Americans are completely unaware of, right? I mean, I think if we polled even cable listeners how many were familiar with it, it would be surprisingly small. And I think that it's these frameworks that privilege the American perspective and experience and propaganda of itself that are really feed into the problem. As we've seen this past year, the selective sort of use of information, of false information, has really been a public health hazard, with many people still refusing to get the COVID vaccine. And many of these people are people who hold values which are deeply tied to the colonial state, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, in a sense, the colonial state that we are part of needs to be more fully grappled with, recognized, understood, because it has an incredible impact on our lives, even impacting responses to climate change, right? Right now, you know, even getting these infrastructure bills passed, you know, on every level, it diminishes our lives. And so it really does need to be dealt with in a much more honest way. I would discourage people from participating in, you know, sort of rhetoric of American exceptionalism, and because it doesn't help us. We really need to, we really need to deal with the system in a much more overt way, a more concrete way, because, it's reducing our, right now we're facing another wildfire season. Of course, we've had the Bootleg Fire, one of the biggest, wildfires in the country, which is now, of course, under control mostly. But we still live in the fear of the rest of the summer that it's going to happen again. And then we'll have another September 2020 where, the AQI, the Air Quality Index, was over 450 here for over a week in Oregon and going up north to British Columbia. you know, it's and that made that meant that we were living in a situation where we could not breathe the air without harming our lungs.
And of course, that's it's been
and yeah, it meant that we were living with the worst air quality in the world. I think Mumbai, India, is like 250 AQI, and Beijing, China. I mean, we had by far the worst air quality.
And of course, that's going on up in upper, you know, northern and eastern Washington, and even Minnesota has had even as far as New York City. These are terrible, dangerous times for sure. And I think you're. It may be difficult for some people to draw that connection, but the whole sort of what we now call fake news, the fictionalizing tendency imposed initially by the colonizers. I think that's exactly right. That really an important point. I just want to reintroduce us. I'm Paul Rowland, regular host of Wednesday Talk Radio. My second Wednesday co-host is Jacqueline Keeler on the line. And we've had a caller actually since early on. Let me just mention the phone number to call in, 503-231-8187. Let's see if that caller is still with us. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, introduce yourself.
Hi, my name's Ted. And you guys are so right about this. And American exceptionalism is like the most stupid concept I've ever heard. But I'm just calling to interject something about the Owyhee River, and it's very timely. I hope this isn't abuse of your radio station. But you know this proposal by the Air Force to turn the Owyhee River into a training ground for fighter pilots has a deadline of August 23rd to get comments in opposition. And I'm going to do everything I can to oppose that. It's a disgusting notion. They want to make very low-level flights at supersonic speeds in the Owyhee River. Please, listeners, help me stop this.
Okay. That was short and sweet and to the point. Owyhee River, I'm sure people can easily look that up. Speaking of, I believe that's in eastern Oregon as well. I guess we lost that caller. 503-231-8187 is a number to call in to join the conversation. We are here till 9 o'clock this morning, as always on the morning talk show. So we talked about the Nez Perce. I had a few other issues I had brought up. What else do you want to talk about this morning?
The Owyhee River there. I'm looking at the article here on Oregon Public Broadcasting's website, and it definitely looks really very intrusive, and to use such a beautiful area for military operations. And certainly we've seen that in Indian country. My mom grew up in Cameron, Arizona, on the Navajo Nation, right near the south rim of the Grand Canyon. You know, we have hundreds of abandoned uranium mines, and very few of the uranium mines on the Navajo Nation, which there are over 500 abandoned uranium mines, have been mitigated. And so you have the Navajo Nation, which is the size of Ireland, right? Being left with a situation where they want to grow. We want to continue to have Navajo people living on the Navajo Nation. There's about 370,000 enrolled tribal citizens, and yet our growth as a nation and safety of our children and grandchildren are deeply impacted and endangered by these uranium mines, which were mined by the U.S. government in order to provide uranium to the nuclear program, including Hiroshima and Nagasaki tragically bombing those two cities, and then also the big Cold War buildup of nuclear arms, the arms race in in the post-war period. I think it's, and yet, you know, these uranium mines endanger our people for generations to come, and that war is over, right? It's, and yet there is very little money being put to actually cleaning them up. And certainly there is, I was disturbed in the Biden plan to see that nuclear power was part of the plan to sort of fight back climate change. I don't know that it, but that was, you know, they're going to be able to talk about that part of that plan, but that is, then that, I would not like to see any of those uranium mines being reopened.
Indeed.
And there is a fight to basically approve a new one near the Grand Canyon itself.
Well, obviously you could go on and on at great length the whole issue of militarization of of Indigenous America, given that that's how colonization happened and Native peoples were kept under military control. And in some sense, that's really continued in a lot of different ways. But
I make a point in my book, Standoff, to note that the militarized response to Standing Rock, to the Dakota Access Pipeline resistance, was basically the military occupation of our homelands made visible, right? Of course, you note the really differing responses to the Bundy standoff at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge versus that at Standing Rock, which was nonviolent, but faced a great deal of overt violence, and both of these responses were led by the county sheriff of their respective counties, and so the county sheriff in Morton County in North Dakota, which is a county that exists in violation of treaty, and treaty is not only international law, but under the Constitution is the highest law of the land, and all of that area west of the Missouri River and south of the Heart River is all under treaty, is supposed to be part of the Great Sioux Nation, a treaty ratified by the Senate. And so so Morton County is a county that exists in violation of international law, yet the sheriff of that county felt completely fine basically leading a military assault on the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, and which was standing on treaty. The treaty also stipulates that the tribe had rights to the crossing of the Missouri River. The Great Sioux Nation has rights to that, and the pipeline crossed the Missouri River. So I make a point of pointing it out in the book that that the militarized response is there. It's always there. And when I interviewed the Burns Paiute tribal leaders, they told me that, and in their press conference, they reiterated this, that that if they had tried to take over the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, which was originally part of their reservation, it used to be called the Malheur Indian Reservation. It was 10 times the size of the refuge, but they would have been, they believe they would have been shot and killed, right?
And of course, speaking of pipelines and crossing waterways, we've got and militarization, we've got the Line 3 in Minnesota with brutalization of protesters and crossing many, 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 many waterways going on right now. Let me, I just want to segue, since we're over halfway through the program and you want to talk about several other things. Just, I know you want to talk about the mascot issue and the, you know, the Cleveland Indians and the Portland Winterhawks. I just want to mention also, sort of as a segue, the sick existence of these, so much military hardware has native names like the Apache helicopter, just to if people, and well, then you got all the automobiles and stuff. It's just such a, we haven't talked about it that much on the show. I don't know if that's something, you know, as we segue into that subject, you want to mention, but it's sort of a, you know, then there's Indian country used to still to talk about, you know, like whether it's Afghanistan or was in Vietnam, that whole military culture is still steeped with this idea of, you know, of, you know, the whole colonial mindset, basically.
Yeah, I think it's, of course, recently the Portland Winterhawks, the local hockey team, basically they've used they use the same mascot being used by the Blackhawks, the Chicago Blackhawks. And they actually came upon that mascot because they received hand-me-down jerseys from the Chicago team. And so they continued to do this for quite a long time until recently. And sort of flew under, I think, a lot of scrutiny. It's not maybe as prominent a team as other teams here in Portland. But it's been on the certainly we've been trying to get them to change for several years now. And finally they did. They got rid of the Indian head mascot and now have just the hawk. And so I think that's good. We had tried to push the city of Portland to refuse to do red face in city-owned municipal buildings and performance venues. We didn't get very far. We didn't get much response from the Office of Racial Equity or something.
Was that at all part of the Winter Hawks culture? Did people do that?
Not really. No, it was the reason we focused on city-owned properties is because there were a few times. I know I was kind of shocked to hear that Wayne Coyne of the Flaming Lips. He was recently on a local radio show. What's that show called? A live show on NPR. But he was doing a lot of red face, like wearing a headdress. He was also hanging out with the Republican governor's daughter, who was also liking to wear red face a lot. Her mother was responsible for basically stealing a Cherokee child, the Baby Veronica case, which went to the Supreme Court. And so we were protesting the Flaming Lips being at the waterfront. And then that same year, I think that was 2015, we also protested Ted Nugent performing at the Expo, and these are both city-owned venues, and of course Nugent, you know, wears a headdress as well as part of his performance, and so we were basically trying to get the city to not allow anything like that in their own venues, which is something that we got with the San Francisco Giants back in 2014. My cousin was at they had an event which was kind of Native American Heritage Day, and they invited the Native community to come. And so my cousin with his wife and they went, and then he got involved in an altercation over a headdress. Some white guy was there, and he was wearing a headdress, and my cousin, a woman he didn't know, a grad student there from UC Davis, a Native woman, she asked him to come with him. My cousin's a big guy; he played football and. You know, he's a big Indian guy, and so they went over, and she wanted to confront this guy and have him take the headdress off, and then they got it back, they gave it to them, and as they were heading back to their seats, the guy then called the police on them, and then my cousin and the woman were actually beaten down to the ground by the city police that were working the event, and then arrested. Right. The woman was like tiny, and she was basically they twisted her arm behind her back and lifted her up by the hair and threw her to the ground. And my cousin's a big guy, like I said, and they had several people on him, you know, holding him down. And when he sent me video that night of what happened, all you could see was his feet. I didn't even know that was him with all those police, those cops piled on him. So we then were able to through the help from folks. And I used to work as a journalist and stuff in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we were able to basically talk to the owner of the Giants team, and he banned during Giants games from that stadium. He banned red face at that point and set up a system where people could call it in and report it. But that was across the country is particularly in publicly owned venues to stop this, and of course. You know, the Washington NFL team recently, in the past few weeks, announced that they are going to ban red face from their games. So that's just a lot. We've come a long way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, those are important. I'm surprised that Portland didn't. Maybe it just seemed kind of, outside the, what they think really happens much. But obviously those you know, major public figures like the Flaming Lips and Nugent continue to use those. I assume the guy from Flaming Lips has backed off on that, but I don't know. But just to, it seems like an important.
We had a young couple come, and they went, and they were going into the show, and they basically snuck a big sign in to the show, the Flaming Lips show, and they held it above right in front of Wayne Coyne's face, and they said they could hear him say, "Oh, you know, OF." And stuff. So he knew that Native people were there protesting him, and did not appreciate his misuse of something that's really quite sacred. You know, these headdresses are symbols of leadership and of the people's love of leaders who are have earned their respect. And then said, you know, he was using it in an entirely different way. So
we got about 20 minutes left, and I wanted to get to the, you know, we're coming into some 100-degree-plus days here in Portland in the Northwest, and we, you know, we thought that was a 1,000-year event. That 116. I certainly hope I don't see another one or too many more of those. Although I'm not holding my breath, but here we are, just a month and a half later, and we've got another 100-plus-degree. Event happening. So I want to talk a little bit about the revisit the whole Klamath Basin issue, and the, you know, the drought, and the issue of climate change and the cultural conflict going down there. But since we're on the mascot issue, I just want to give you, we haven't really had a chance to talk, I don't think, since it happened. The, you know, the Cleveland Indians is a big one. Maybe you just want to give your reaction to that.
Yeah, I was born in Cleveland in an inner suburb called Lakewood, which I should know, Lakewood is considered one of the most walkable and densely populated suburbs in the country, and all the students there walk to school, no buses, and it was one of the oldest streetcar neighborhoods, and so my parents' generation my parents met in Cleveland because they were part of the Indian Relocation Program. And the Indian Relocation Program actually grew out of the Termination Movement. In the late 40s and 1950s, Congress passed the Termination Act and the Relocation Act. And the purpose of that was to terminate tribes so that they don't exist anymore and they're not a political issue. And that was quite detrimental to the tribes here in Oregon. Many were terminated. In fact, the termination movement was led by an Oregon congressman, and the goal was to gain access to their land, their remaining land, particularly land that was rich with timber. And so many tribes lost their land and their timber, and the timber was then available for commercial use, right? And then the other aspect of the termination relocation program was to relocate the population of Native people from their homelands, from their reservations, to urban centers, you know, where they would hopefully then melt into the population and disappear. And so between the 50s into the early 1970s, the government ran a program that basically offered relocation assistance to young people between the ages of 18 and 30 to leave the reservation and go to the city and go to school or get jobs. And so some young people did this, and my mom and my dad did this. And, you know, my mom left her little community of Cameron, Arizona, on the Navajo Nation, and moved to Cleveland, Ohio, as a young woman. And she did. She went and she got an education. It was tough. It was not easy. I think it was helpful to her to have a community, a white community that was very ethnic itself and had ethnic identities. Cleveland is there's still a strong immigrant, population kind of identities there from, you know, over 100 years ago, that immigration period from Europe. And so it kind of helped her feel not as weird having such a strong Navajo identity. My grandparents were traditional Navajos who did not speak English. Navajo was my mother's first language, is my mother's first language. And so it was quite, I think it helped her in some ways, but the issue of mascots, you know, there was not a very large population of Native people in Cleveland since basically the 1830s, 1850s. After Tecumseh lost, you know, they lost the Ohio Valley, the tribes did, and they were pushed farther west. At that point, a lot of the tribes were driven from the state of Ohio, the Shawnee and the Seneca Mingo, and all of these tribes were pushed out, some of them pushed to Oklahoma, to Indian Territory. And so, so this was the first time there had been a large group of Native people. They estimate there were probably usually a population of about 9,000, probably over the entire period of the program, maybe 20,000 young Native people went through Cleveland. And those young Native people, when they got there, they noticed that there was this awful mascot called Chief Wahoo. And so they began organizing, protesting against it. And so that finally took fruit. That took from the probably 50 years of protesting. And so it feels good to have that in the rearview mirror. Although I think that I'm working on a piece right now where I really want to draw attention to what it meant to be part of the Cleveland Native American community. Certainly, I'm a product of it. I wouldn't be here without it, actually, even without the relocation program. My parents probably would never have met from very different reservations. And so I think it's an interesting, it was an interesting experience to my parents, meeting other young Native people from all over the country, you know, working together collectively. You know, they started their Cleveland Native American Center. That's where I, as an infant and as a toddler, went to my first powwows. You know, my mom makes fry bread every weekend. And they'd have a powwow, and so it was. And I think when you talk about the Red Power movement, when you talk about the about sort of the sovereignty movement, that was really the product, partly the product of all these young people meeting each other in these relocation centers. There were 8 relocation centers across the country. Minneapolis was one, Oakland, Dallas, Texas, and Los Angeles all had relocation centers, and Denver, Colorado. And these became centers of Native thought, of Native action, of intermarriage, of building bonds, and intellectual responses to our problems. And so we owe a lot, actually, ironically, to the relocation movement, because it really grew a lot of the resistance that you see today, and began to articulate and create relationships between tribes that didn't exist before, you know, strengthen those relationships if they already existed. And so it's something that has not been looked at enough, yet it's still having an impact on our lives today. And often the relocation program is viewed negatively as, you know, something that where a lot of young Native people suffered in these urban places. But there are there's another aspect to that I think has been missed. And I often find that I think that we need more empowering stories about how we succeeded. I think young Native people need that in particular, because that is that gives them hope that they could succeed. And there are a lot of success stories that came out of the relocation program. And I don't think of success stories simply as being rich or whatever, but I see it more as a way in which that young generation that came of age in the 60s and 70s, how they began to fight back mentally against colonization. And there is a lot of success stories in that respect.
And of course, the success is that the Cleveland Indians, after retiring Chief Wahoo a few months ago, they will cease using the name Indians following this season, this year. So again, this is a Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the regular host on a weekly basis, Paul Rowland. I've got my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, with me on the line. And we're talking about a whole bunch of news from Native North America, as I called it on my program page this time around. And we haven't had a caller. Well, we had one caller, 503-231-8187. You can, maybe if you call in the next 5 minutes, we can get you in. But I did want to transition, since we talked a couple times about that Klamath Basin issue, the irrigation, the draining off of the Klamath, Upper Klamath Lake, and colonization, the white, mostly white agriculturalists, almost exclusively white agriculturalists, who feel it's their divine right to have all that water to themselves, and in conflict with the various native tribes who depend upon that water, including for the fish that live in the water, and the water levels have been declining for quite some time, and there's been various flashpoints. And so one thing that happened was last week, the protest tent that was put up by two local farmers as a, quote, water crisis information center was taken down a week ago. Good news. And it looks kind of like it just fizzled out. It said other local farmers just weren't really coming around to their events. And so they basically didn't seem to gain the kind of traction that Malheur Rebellion did a few years back, huh?
Yeah, it does. They took the tents down. They had two farmers, Grant Knoll and Dan Nielsen, had purchased about 200 acres in the Klamath Project. And they purchased a plot of land, or they farmed that 200 acres, and they purchased a plot of land next to the Bureau of Reclamation's canal headgate. And just this past spring, and they were sort of threatening to, the water was turned off by the Bureau, and they were threatening to sort of do what they had done before, which was to turn the valve back on and to release the water. And of course, that water is needed downstream. Otherwise, there'd be a huge, massive fish kill if it's already sort of happening in the Lower Klamath. And so they brought in volunteers from actually Ammon Bundy's people rights organization, People Rights Oregon. He's been training a militia group in Idaho throughout the pandemic and responding, offering to come to the aid of people who are resisting sort of COVID restrictions, masking and stuff like that, to bring an armed response. And he's been positioning himself in active opposition to any sort of pandemic restrictions in Idaho. And he is now running for governor of Idaho as well. And so maybe that's why he's distracted from this particular thing. But it should be pointed out that Malheur did not attract a lot of local support either from the ranchers, who had almost been, were very happy with the agreements they had already made with the Fish and Wildlife Service regarding the use compact for the Malheur area and the different land trades they had done with the federal government. And so that doesn't stop this sort of movement. In response, it's interesting. I think it's hopefully it won't explode. But there is more troubling news, which is that from that area, that the wells in the Klamath Basin are going dry, and so there have been. Do you ever see those Milky Way trucks on the freeway? the silver long tubular trucks that have like a cow on the back. Anyway, they've been using those water trucks to those milk trucks to basically bring water to people's homes, and which I should note is interesting because of course on the Navajo Nation we don't, most places, almost a third of the Navajo Nation I think doesn't have running water, and yet there's been no emergency response to that from the federal level of providing water to Navajo people. I mean, my grandparents lived in a home without running water for almost their entire lives until the 21st century. It's sort of funny that the minute
and of course,
people don't have water.
And of course, Warm Springs has been having a terrible, terrible water crisis with poisoned water systems and pipe. Just antiquated pipe systems. I believe the federal government has finally stepped in and provided some funding. And I guess that's a big part of this whole infrastructure fight is over, is exactly addressing just these terrible longstanding water, from Flint, Michigan to Warm Springs to wherever. But anyway, that's a really a good point that they've got these shiny trucks pressed into service to bail out the... One thing I don't know, what you... Is it too much to hope that in addition to the lack of local support, that perhaps some kind of reality factor, like, you know, 84 in July, dry wells registered in Klamath County jumped to 185 since then. That's just astounding. I wonder if can that be playing into the fact that they're not getting support, that there's just a reality setting in that there really is a serious water crisis going on?
Yeah, I mean, they were the farmers are there because they were promised water by the federal government and over 100 years ago, and there may need to be some kind of settlement because in a sense the federal government 100 years ago promised something that was not possible. I think even then the water was over allocated. It was just kind of kicked down the road. Water over allocation is a problem throughout the West, and they sort of just I think even from the original 1920 compacts, they just over allocated water, and that problem has just increased over the past 100 years, and so we are going to see a huge reckoning over water in the West. The livability of the West is really in question, I think, and certainly reports have shown that it's going to, cost a lot of money. I mean, I think we're facing a very scary summer. I think the issue of fish kills as well, of die-off in our oceans and waters. I mean, in the last heat wave, billions of died in the oceans from the heat, and certainly. Fisheries along the Columbia River, were deeply impacted by the heat wave that happened, and so this is still. We're facing it again in the next 3 days, and of course not quite as high. I think we're only not quite 110 degrees, like last time it went over 115 or something. So it's it's. The legacy of colonialism, accompanied by the drug of white supremacy, is harming our world, and we are seeing it in real time all around us. And of course, the UN issued that paper, the climate change paper, earlier a few days ago, and it paints a really quite a troubling picture, and that's what we're facing in the future. And what we're facing now is quite we really do have to grapple with and I in my book Standoff I really compare colonialism and indigeneity to algorithms, and I think it's very helpful to use that framework to understand them, because when you think of algorithms, you think of them as sort of a series of if-then statements that have outcomes, right? And what colonialism is a series of if-then statements, and that we need to basically break that down and change that algorithm because it's a runaway algorithm at this point of destruction.
Indeed, and unfortunately, our ability to actually influence the physical world, once we've, I mean, that's just the thing that's really hard to grapple with. I think most people just didn't. The idea that we could actually, humans could actually influence the natural systems to the extent that they could actually start breaking down and changing the way they are is really astounding. But the things that we do have some control over are, as you say, the language we use and the way we think about it. And to the extent that, that continues to cause damage, obviously that's what we need to get a hold on, and hopefully we can limit some of the damage. Anyway, that's a huge subject that we're getting into at the end of the show, and we're just about out of time. So, change, decolonize or death, I guess, at this point, huh?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, I can't even... I know. I think that's what is the region of the country? They said the Great Lakes area is the area where you can, it's probably the least impacted. And of course, it's the all those Rust Belt cities, you know. It's you know, they're inland, they're not exposed to as much forest fire or you know, water, ocean, you know, the oceans and all that stuff, and they have the infrastructure, right? And well, they have drinking water.
Unfortunately, we can't all move there. But anyway, that's well, we are all out of time. So once again, Jacqueline Keeler, thank you so much. Always good to talk to you and hear from you.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye, everybody. Signing off.
Hold your head up. Lift the top of your mind. Put your eyes on the earth. Lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude?
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
FM Community Radio.
Your investment in community radio can go on with a planned gift to KABU. Consider adding KABU to your will or add KABU as a beneficiary to your insurance.